system is not the one being covered by mainstream candidates.
In the United States, the school system is viewed as an educational ladder, a concept used by the Americans to reflect the value of individual success and the equal opportunity for working one's way to the top. However, although the Civil Rights Acts of the mid-1960s eventually ended, the legality of the infamous practice of school segregation and educational inequality in the U.S., students still receive dramatically different learning opportunities based on their social status. In many areas, the cost of education is rising much more rapidly than the average family income is. There are striking differences between white and non-white students' access to key educational resources, including skilled teachers, quality curriculum, sufficient funding, and essential classroom materials. Schools receive a large percentage of their money from local property taxes. As a result, the wealthier school districts offer better educational opportunities. Recent reports show that predominantly white school districts receive nearly $23 billion more in funding than other non-white school districts, despite serving roughly the same number of students. This shows that racial gaps in residential patterns are directly linked to educational disparities in the U.S.
A series of university research in the year 2019 surprisingly showed that New York schools are the most segregated in the U.S. That revealed that they not only isolated students by race, but also by their socioeconomic status. Let's hear more about that.
We have such a disparity between schools that largely serve black and Latino populations and then the small number of schools that white parents tend to send their children to. And so I've been covering school segregation for a long time, but then had my own child who was 4 years old and I was having to suddenly pick a school for her in this very segregated system.
Even if these schools were roughly equivalent academically, as that would still be a violation of the principle of Brown versus Board of Education that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. But in practice, they are very rarely equal in any way. Black and Latino children are more likely to attend schools with inexperienced teachers, which are then less likely to offer a college prep curriculum. On top of which, because race and class are inextricably linked, those students are six times as likely to be in high poverty schools. And while there are teachers and students working incredibly hard in those places, they are often doing so with fewer resources.
Okay, I mean, talking about this in the year 2020 is quite incredible. All right, Nicole Hannah-Jones, author of New York Times Magazine article, Choosing a School for My Daughter, is what you heard there, along with John Oliver, just courtesy of them, in order to bring the point across. Well, having heard that, let's get our first guest in and hear the guest's opinion about the ongoing racism crisis that's happening at U.S. schools and the potential political solutions for this problem. James Brewer is an assistant professor of social foundations of education at the University of North Georgia with expertise in education policy surrounding issues of public schools, the privatization of schools, and issues of equity and justice. Hello, Jameson. Welcome to Decision 2020. First question, the U.S. has a clear two-pronged approach when it comes to schooling, with white middle classes being at a clear advantage compared to the black lower classes. How do you think that this should be addressed when it comes to each of the mainstream candidates?
I think that it's clear that the United States has a historical equity issue when it comes to racial justice across our society, but especially in our schools. Something that we learned just last year that we've always known intuitively is that schools that dominantly serve white students receive approximately an additional $23 billion in funding per year. Now, of course, the significant portion of that difference is because the way that we fund schools is heavily dependent on property taxes here in the United States.
Wow, interesting point that he makes there. We appreciate that, James Brewer. He talked about equity issue and how white students are receiving, the schools that is, $20 billion more when it comes to their budget in terms of property taxes perhaps. And of course that is a clear disadvantage for the schools that have people of color in it. Well, when we take a look at the way that this situation is evolving in the U.S., Keeping the schools safe is another challenge that U.S. administrations have been facing amid a steady rise in school shootings all across the country in the past decades.
Research shows that a majority of American teenagers are worried about the possibility of a shooting happening at their schools. Many students and parents are outraged by what they refer to as gross incompetence on part of school and law enforcement officials. They have repeatedly called for gun legislation and further school safety measures, but different U.S. administrations, whether Republican or Democrat, have flip-flopped on their pledges for new gun control laws. Although some state legislators have passed several gun control regulations in recent years, the National Rifle Association continues to press lawmakers to prioritize the interests of gun owners across the U.S. That shows that the fate of hundreds of thousands of innocent children lies in the hands of one of the most powerful lobby groups in the U.S., the foremost defender of the country's controversial Second Amendment of the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Anxiety over potential school shootings has created a common fear among Americans, and many people persistently use any platform that they have to express their anger towards these senseless tragedies. Okay, back to our guest, James Brewer, professor of Social Foundations of Education, UNG, to talk about this violent practice and its consequences for the U.S. education system. James Brewer, welcome back. Gun crime and mass shootings is a major issue in schools in the U.S. Having seen multiple occasions where atrocities have been committed on school grounds, how do you think education can actually play a part in ending gun crime?
I think that it's also clear that the United States has a gun violence problem. I think that we have in this country approximately 2 to 3 guns for every person in our country. So I think that the answer to the question, I think that schools can play a part. I think that clearly teachers and educators and administrators and counselors think that they can, and historically they always have been, and we can continue to serve students and serve community needs and provide resources for students who are hurting, provide resources to communities and the broader society. But I think that the answer to the question, I think it has to come from a broad societal sort of examination of how this country approaches particularly gun ownership, but also the mass expansion of gun ownership over the past few decades, because I think that teachers and educators can play a part, but I think it would be very difficult for teachers and schools by themselves to fix what is, in effect, a societal issue.
Okay, thank you very much. That is James Brewer, professor of Social Foundations of Education at UNG, with his comments on that. But, I mean, he makes a lot of good suggestions, granted, but how can the U.S. president, who's saying that Democrat-run cities are the ones that are suffering from crime, if he's segregating it into those two categories, red and blue states, do you think there's going to be any solutions?
The U.S. economy largely relies on its vast infrastructure network. But these systems were built decades ago and they suffer from comparatively low quality. Experts are warned about safety concerns, and the American Society of Civil Engineering has given the U.S. infrastructure a low grade. Daily inconveniences for longer commutes, structural deficiency for bridges, antiquated drinking water, internet provision, wastewater systems, and air transportation all need upgrades and observations. That is while other developed countries enjoy more reliable and efficient services. Meanwhile, different polls show that the majority of American people and businesses support rebuilding the infrastructure. So why is the U.S. lagging behind its international peers such as France, Germany, and Japan in infrastructure? These discrepancies can be traced back to very different funding levels, either through tax, tolls, or private investment.
It seems that the U.S. infrastructure is in a dire state. Let's hear more about this.
We have 16 categories of infrastructure. We put together a pool of experts, about 30 different civil engineers who are analyzing. A lot of it is data that's available through the federal government. So we're looking at aviation, bridges, roads, transit, dams, levees, schools, parks, solid waste, drinking water, wastewater. So all of these different categories are analyzed. Unfortunately, 12 out of the 16 categories are in the D range, which is poor or at risk, which is really reflecting a lot of our infrastructure being at the end of its useful life.
More stimulus is needed. I mean, the two problems the economy faces, the two big headwinds are, number one, obviously the pandemic, and we're not going to see the economy fully recover until the pandemic is totally contained. But the other is we've got to have adequate money in people's pockets. We've got to have a stimulus that enables people to spend. And obviously, if people don't have enough money to spend, they're not going to be able to get the economy moving. The multiplier effect that comes from the bottom 80% of this economy's spending is really what this economy fundamentally depends on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very alarming when you take a look at how, in that report by the engineers for the U.S. in terms of infrastructure as a whole, that you have actually drinking water in the D range. Four out of the six categories is in D range. Well, let's bring in our guests to see what the main economic challenges are that the U.S. Is facing in terms of its infrastructure. We're going to bring in William K. Black, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. William, it's great to have you with us. The U.S. infrastructure is crumbling. I'm sure you'll agree with that. You have roads, rail, and various hubs that are underfunded. How can the U.S. come up with the money to build this up? I mean, some estimates have, for example, stated that billions of dollars are needed and years of work to restore the U.S. water supply, which got a D, by the way, to acceptable standards. That's just one example.
Right. There are huge numbers of productive investments that the United States could make. It's not that everything is crumbling, but certainly we're a major contributor to global climate disruption, and certainly there are many productive things we could do to improve things like the safety of dams and bridges. Indeed, about 6 miles from where I'm giving this interview, a major bridge across the Mississippi River famously fell into the river and killed several people. And so this is a win-win. And the answer to your question directly on funding is the United States, of course, is a nation with a sovereign currency that can borrow or simply issue money in its own currency, even without directly borrowing. So this is modern monetary theory. The problem is not cash. The problem is political willingness. Indeed, it's an inside joke in the United States whenever you say infrastructure week is coming, because President Trump has been, you know, promising for 4 years now that next week he's going to do infrastructure, which would be have great bipartisan support. And, of course, he's never actually done it.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to get back to you. I mean, talk about what he has said, political willingness. I mean, he just mentioned that there was a dam that was that fell apart and killed several people. You have drinking water, again, that had the D range, and people are getting sick off of that. Different states have actually cited that. So we'll see how this is going to pan out. As we already discussed, there seems to be a general consensus on the need for more resources for rebuilding the U.S. infrastructure. What is exactly standing in the way then?
Experts say the U.S. infrastructure faces a funding gap of more than $2 trillion needed by 2025. The intimidating specter raises the question of resource for financing the U.S. infrastructure needs. Many call for increased federal spending and a federal infrastructure bank to generate revenue and offer institutional investment to development projects. However, unlike the European countries that receive the major part of their infrastructure development funding from the national level, the U.S. federal government only provides 25% of the country's needed funding for development. Consequently, many argue that the presence of the private sector is essential. Those who are skeptical of federal government spending say the existence of a public-private partnership would be more efficient and cost-effective. Infrastructure is also critical to the employment rates in the U.S. These show that there is a need for a data-driven approach towards infrastructure funding rather than a politically driven one.
Okay, William, when we look at the impact of the COVID-19 virus hitting certain infrastructures more than others, maybe not directly, where should each candidate then be focusing his or her attention, in this case, his attention, when it comes to truly rebuilding America and making it great again?
COVID hasn't directly attacked infrastructure in the sense of destroying infrastructure, but it certainly has made it more difficult to do things like improve infrastructure by having construction projects that would be inside. And there hasn't been any political will on the part of the Republican majority leader in the Senate to do big infrastructure programs. And so we are in an unusual circumstance politically in which President Trump wants a large bill, including some infrastructure, and where the Democrats want it, but Mitch McConnell controls the Senate as majority leader and is, at least at this juncture, saying that he wants no legislation before the U.S. election, which is, in under 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you very much. William K. Black, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, talking to us there. He did fail to mention about the fact that you still have this almost $3 trillion stimulus package for COVID-19, people who are suffering from it. Add to that the large infrastructure bill that Trump has proposed. How are they going to get to that? They can't even agree on it, so it's a bipartisan issue. And that does it for this edition of the program. I'm Kavitat Lee. It's goodbye for now.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, ritual worships versus non-ritual worships. Brothers and sisters, common understanding of worship is prayer, fasting, hajj, pilgrimage, etc., etc. This limited understanding of worship is only one part of the meaning of worship in Islam. This is why the traditional definition of worship in Islam is a comprehensive definition that includes almost everything in any individual's activities. Highlighting the importance of non-ritual worship in Islam does not mean under-evaluating or undermining the importance of the ritual worship. Actually, ritual worship, if performed in true spirit, elevates man morally and spiritually, and enables him to carry on his activities in all walks of life according to the guidance of God. Among ritual worships, salah, prayer, occupies the key position for two reasons. And we're going to discuss those reasons after the break. But let me get this straight. Brothers and sisters, when we talk about the real concept of worship in Islam and that it is all-encompassing and it is something way beyond the ritualistic worship, by no means are we proposing that the ritual worships are not important and are not essential. This is not the point. Unfortunately, some, you know, people out there, when they look at this concept, they start to like deny the importance of ritual worship. Well, this is not what Islam has taught us. Islam teaches us the importance of ritual worship, and on top of it, Islam teaches us that beyond that ritual worship, there is a bigger concept, more encompassing concept of worship in Islam, and this has to be understood properly. Welcome back to your listeners. Before the break, we were talking about the concept of ritual worship versus the concept of non-ritual worship. So non-ritual worship is all those things other than prayer and fasting and Hajj and Zakat and Khums, you know, all of those tenets of Islam. Now, when we talk about ritual worship, we said that they're equally important. It's not that we can deny the importance of ritual worship. Why? Because now we understand a bigger meaning and more encompassing meaning of worship in Islam. No, that's not the point. The point is that these ritual worships are the stepping stones. They are those, connecting dots for us to get to that real concept of the worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Islam. And among ritual worships, we said salah, or the ritual prayer, occupies the key position for two reasons. Firstly, it is distinctive mark of a believer, and we have several ahadith on that. Secondly, it prevents an individual from all sorts of abominations and vices by providing him chances of direct communication with his Creator five times a day, wherein he renews his covenant with God and seeks his guidance again and again. As Quran in chapter 1, verse number 5 and 6 says, "You alone we worship, and to you alone we turn for help. Guide us to the straight path." So don't misunderstand the importance of ritual worship when compared to non-ritual worship. We believe in the more encompassing meaning of worship that includes the ritual worship as well. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. 3 years ago, a military operation in Myanmar destroyed entire Rohingya Muslim villages. United Nations investigators say as many as 10,000 people were killed, and more than 730,000 Rohingya Muslims fled the massacre for neighboring Bangladesh. The United Nations called it a textbook ethnic cleansing. After fleeing a brutal crackdown which left thousands of people dead in their homeland of Myanmar, the Rohingya are once again under threat. In Cox's Bazar, the massive refugee camp in Bangladesh, to which many of the Rohingya refugees have fled, violence and drug and human trafficking are on the rise. The Bangladeshi government has begun relocating hundreds of the refugees to the small remote silt island of Basanchar. For the past 3 years, the authorities have been building a new town at a cost of $350 million. Their aim is to relocate more than 100,000 refugees in order to ease tensions within the camps. Bangladesh's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, has frequently defended her government's plans, urging the international community to understand that, with over a million refugees living in Cox's Bazar, the escalation in violence, as well as both drug and human trafficking, shows the camps are no longer safe nor sustainable. We now present you an article written by Akbar Hossein under the heading, Far From Home, Rohingya Refugees Face New Peril on a Remote Island. The article has been taken from the WNewsNetwork.com. Please stay with us for more of Akbar Hossein's article. After fleeing a brutal crackdown which left thousands of people dead in their homeland of Myanmar, the Rohingya Muslims are once again under threat. In Cox's Bazar, the massive refugee camp in neighboring Bangladesh, to which many of the Rohingya refugees have fled, violence and drug and human trafficking are on the rise. The Bangladeshi government has begun relocating hundreds of refugees against their will to the small remote silt island of Basanchar. On the first visit to the island by journalists, they went to investigate what the future holds for the tens of thousands of Rohingya Muslims still living in limbo. It's been 6 months since 55-year-old Rashida Khatun has heard from her children. Rashida Khatun and her family live in Cox's Bazar, but in February, before the coronavirus had fully taken hold in Bangladesh, two of Rashida's children set off on a perilous journey. Driven by their belief in a better future, her 17-year-old daughter and 22-year-old son boarded a small fishing vessel with 24 other Rohingya refugees and began the 10-day journey from Cox's Bazar to Malaysia. Sitting in her makeshift house of bamboo and plastic with a white headscarf draped over her head and shoulders, Rashida Khatun described how her family fled from their homeland in Myanmar in 2017 after the military attacked her village in Mongdo and burnt down her house. 3 years ago, a military operation in Myanmar destroyed entire Rohingya Muslim villages. United Nations investigators say as many as 10,000 people were killed, and more than 730,000 Rohingya Muslims fled the massacre for neighboring Bangladesh. The United Nations called it a textbook ethnic cleansing operation. After years of living in temporary shelters and with no hope of returning to their ancestral homeland, Rashida Khatun's son and daughter had become desperate to escape the escalating violence and lack of opportunities in the refugee camps. So they decided to flee to the Muslim-majority country of Malaysia. Rashida Khatun said, "One of my relatives in Malaysia phoned me last year. He assured me my daughter would be able to get married there and that my son would be able to get a good job. Traveling by boat from Bangladesh to Malaysia has become the most common route out of the refugee camps for young Rohingya Muslims, but it's a treacherous journey." In the same week, Rashida Khatun's children departed, a fishing boat carrying dozens of refugees capsized just off the coast of Bangladesh. 14 people died in that incident. After 10 days at sea, Rashida Khatun's children, who we have not named to protect their safety, made it within sight of the Malaysian coastline, but they were being tracked by the Malaysian Navy. Refused permission to dock by the Malaysian authorities, their tiny fishing vessel was left stranded for a month, floating in the Andaman Sea. Eventually, Bangladesh's Coast Guard, bowing under the pressure from local media and human rights groups, intervened. Along with hundreds of other refugees who had also been refused entry to Malaysia, Rashida Khatun's children were not allowed to return home to the camp of Cox's Bazar, but were instead taken to the small island of Basanchar in the Bay of Bengal. Back in Cox's Bazar, Rashida Khatun received a call from an unknown number. Rashida Khatun says, "My daughter sounded very anxious. She was crying when she told me that she was being taken to an island named Basanchar. It was the last time she spoke to her daughter." The island of Basanchar, located 60 kilometers off the coast of Bangladesh, emerged less than 20 years ago from the sea. Situated less than 2 meters above sea level, the island is made entirely of silt, Himalayan sediment washed down river and into the sea. For the past 3 years, the authorities have been building a new town at a cost of $350 million. Their aim is to relocate more than 100,000 refugees in order to ease tensions within the refugee camps. Bangladesh's Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, has frequently defended her government's plans, urging the international community to understand that, with over 1 million refugees living in Cox's Bazar, the escalation in violence as well as both drug and human trafficking shows the refugee camps are no longer safe nor sustainable. She said at the United Nations General Assembly last year, "The crisis is now becoming a regional threat. Besides increasing congestion and environmental degradation, it's also challenging health and security in the area." But for many Rohingya Muslims, the island of Basanchar is closer to a prison than a refugee camp. All of the 306 refugees living on the island, including Rashida Khatun's 2 children, were relocated to the island against their will, and none are allowed to leave the island. Under pressure from the United Nations Human Rights Council to stop sending Rohingya to the island against their will, the Bangladeshi authorities are now engaging in an all-out marketing campaign to promote the island as a spacious and modern alternative to the conditions faced by those living in the refugee camps. Their efforts include taking a small pool of journalists on an exclusive media tour of the facilities, all coordinated by and under the watchful eye of the Bangladeshi Navy and intelligence services. After 3 hours' travel on board a Navy vessel, Commodore Abdullah Al-Ma'mun Chaudhry escorted the small band of journalists around the newly finished site. The newly built Basanchar town forms a giant grid with hundreds of rows of red-roofed houses. All that journalists saw stood vacant, waiting for an influx of refugees. Overhead, installed on every house and every corner, security cameras kept watch. Bangladeshi Navy officials were keen to point out two schools, a mosque, two 40-bed hospitals, and two community clinics, all currently under construction. Chaudhry said, "The infrastructure is eco-friendly," he added. "There is plenty of open space. Here they will have electricity, which they don't have in Cox's Bazar refugee camp. The most important thing is education. We have constructed schools for Rohingya children where they will get better education." Earlier this year, Amnesty International released a damning report on the conditions faced by the 306 Rohingya already living on the island of Basanchar. The report contained allegations of cramped and unhygienic living conditions, limited food and healthcare facilities, a lack of phones in order for refugees to be able to contact their families, as well as cases of abuse by both the Bangladeshi Navy and local labourers engaging in extortion. Commodore Chaudhry denied the allegations. He said, "We are taking care of them as our guests," he added. "They are given proper food and access to all the facilities." When Commodore Chaudhry was asked about the whereabouts of the 306 Rohingya already on the island, he said none was available to meet the gathered journalists. As the tour continued beyond the vacant buildings and out into the fields, some signs of life emerged from the swathes of green grass. Hundreds of buffalo and sheep stood grazing, and watching over them was 50-year-old cattle rancher Tajul Haq, who said he had been working on the island for the past 5 years, caring for the buffalo. Tajul Haq said, "I look after around 100 buffalo on behalf of the owner. The island is full of grass, so suitable for buffalo. The land is also very fertile. You can grow anything here." The Bangladeshi government has long promised the United Nations access to the island of Basanchar in order to carry out an official assessment of the long-term safety and sustainability of the island. But the Bangladeshi authorities are still holding the United Nations at bay, leaving the question of whether the land can provide enough food, facilities and livelihood opportunities to support 100,000 people unanswered. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said that with the arrival of 306 refugees, an on-site visit by the United Nations was now even more crucial to assess the conditions for those already living on the island. They said they had submitted their request to the Bangladeshi government but were yet to hear back. Many Rohingya Muslims are also concerned that the island, at just 6 feet above sea level, is extremely vulnerable to cyclones, to monsoon rains and tidal surges. Commodore Chaudhry said during a PowerPoint presentation to journalists that not only had a 14-kilometer-long seawall been constructed to protect the island, but that experts had established the risk of the island being hit by a cyclone as very low. Commodore Chaudhry said, No severe cyclone eye has hit this area in the last 172 years. He showed off what he said was 120 cyclone shelters capable of withstanding 260 kilometers per hour winds. But contrary to Commodore Chaudhry's claim, there is evidence to suggest two cyclones did in fact track right across or very close to the island of Basanchar in 1991 and in 1997. And it is well documented the damage caused by cyclones frequently occurs many miles from the eye of the storm. Bangladesh experiences an average of more than one cyclonic storm every year, and weather experts said the likelihood of Basanchar being affected in the future was high, and that the topography and low-lying ground meant such storms could cause major flooding, both from excessive rainfall and from coastal storm surges. The isolation of the island of Basanchar is also something the Rohingya Muslims fear. Back on board the Bangladeshi Navy vessel after the Commodore's tour, it was another three-hour rough ride back to the mainland. Nur Hussein, a Rohingya camp resident who had seen pictures of the island and spoken to Rohingya elders who visited, said, "The houses are good in Basanchar, but it looks like a prison." He said, "In Cox's Bazar, we're living as a community," he added, "but on the island, our freedom would be restricted. We would have to live under Bangladeshi Navy surveillance." For others in the refugee camps, living so close to the border between Bangladesh and their homeland of Myanmar offers some solace. And the option of moving to a remote island feels like a shift even further away from their dreams of returning home. One community elder, who was among 40 or so taken on a tour of the island in September, but who asked not to be identified for fear of retribution, explained the importance of the refugee camps being close to the border with Myanmar. He said, "The Bangladesh government wants us, the elders, to speak publicly in the refugee camps in favor of the island of Basanchar. However, the general population brands us traitors if we speak for relocation," he added. "They are dead against the plans to relocate to the island. It doesn't matter how beautiful the infrastructure is. The Rohingya Muslims feel connected to their roots in Myanmar while staying in Cox's Bazar." Even for Rashida Khatun, the idea of leaving the camps to be reunited with her children is too much of a risk, because for her, the refugee camps were always temporary, and 3 years on, her aim is still for all of her family to return to Myanmar. She said, "I want my son and my daughter back here." She added, "Why should I go there? Here, Myanmar is close. If we get justice, we shall go back to Myanmar as soon as possible. I will not go to Basanchar."
Being here at Mass Ikna has become something of a pleasurable tradition for me. I first participated in the Interfaith Symposium in its inaugural year in 2015, and this is my third time visiting with you. I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS in the first place because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. And now while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own. A community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become both more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the world's walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, We need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City. Friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost, and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion, on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer, truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium. Namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.